When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Rock and Roll Farming is proud to be part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network. For more great agriculture-related podcasts and vlogs, please visit farmruralag.com.
Farm Africa!
Oye!
Uganda!
Oye!
Kanungu!
Oye!
Youth!
Oye!
Women!
Oye!
Coffee!
Oye!
UK!
Oye!
What you've just heard is the reaction of farmers in Kanunga, Uganda, to hearing that Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal has launched. Between 8th of February and 8th of May, donations in support of my London Marathon Challenge will go to Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal. If you can donate before 8th of May 2019, all public donations to Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal will be doubled by the UK government. What a country. Your donation will support Farm Africa projects across Eastern Africa, and the matched funding you unlock from the UK government will directly fund a Farm Africa project that will give women in Kanungu in Western Uganda the opportunity to make a decent living from coffee farming. I'm trying to raise £5,000 to support the appeal, and if you could spare anything at all, we would greatly appreciate it. Just visit justgiving.com/fundraising/William-Evans12, and I will put that link in the show notes. Thank you. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 108. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am heading down to Radnor, just south of Birmingham, to talk to dairy farmer and National Farmers Union Dairy Board Chairman, Michael Oakes. Michael, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. I'm actually quite honoured that you think that I'm even worthy of appearing on your podcast. I think it's I'm going to have to retire after this.
Well, finally, we've got round to it. We've been trying to do it for about a year, haven't we?
Well, yeah, we talked about it a while ago, but it's the way it is.
Yeah, are you enjoying this unseasonably good weather we're having? It's been fantastic, isn't it?
Oh yeah, I mean the cows are looking over the gate, thinking we should. Every tweet you see, somebody's let their cows out. But then actually, this time last year, I was searching for a space heater and a great big gas bottle just to try and stop my parlour from freezing up.
Yeah, you can't help but feel there might be a sting in the tail yet, can't you?
Who knows? It's quite odd, isn't it? We had the wet spring last year. We had the drought. Things do tend to even themselves out, as much as people keep telling you that. They do. If people get the opportunity to get a bit of grazing now, but I mean, ultimately, if we have to bring the cows back in, it's not the end of the world.
No, absolutely. All right, tell us about your farm then, Michael. What have you got going on down there?
We milk just under 200 Holsteins, we started farming in 1976 with my parents. We got a county council small holding in Staffordshire, which was 28 acres. Which seems like a field and a half these days, but that's what it was. I mean, Dad went out to work. I would sort of come home from school and start milking, and I'd get up and milk the cows with him before I went to school. And what was quite good fun for probably the first 6 months turned into they were your job. initially it was voluntary, and then actually after you'd done it for 6 months, it became obligatory. And actually, I never complained and I never regretted it. And, it was a great childhood. We were only at that first farm sort of 18 months. And then we got another farm, another county council holding in Staffordshire, which was 50 acres near Eccleshaw. We were there 6 years. There was no milking parlour. We put a parlour in. Initially, the cows were all tied up by the neck. And, we had 25 cows looking at each other in this cow stall. So we thought, how's the best way to get silage into these cows. So we put a little railway line down the middle. We bought from an old quarry and a bogey. And we used to have a big fork, and we'd tip the silage onto this little bogey, and it would be like a gondola. We'd go down the middle of the bed, and we'd be forking the silage into the front of the cows. So, I owe my dad a lot, because actually he did manage to get a lot of milk out of cows in a really simple, low-cost system that I think I've managed to add a lot of costing since in those days, but I did learn a lot from him, and he's still around annoying me every now and again, even though he's now retired. He just wanders around and tells me what I'm doing wrong.
Oh, well, they all do that, don't they? So, I mean, how do you, you mentioned that your dad got started on a Staffordshire County Council farm. I was reading the other day, they're now selling a proportion of their council farms off. How do you feel about that when you read things like that? Because
I rang a Staffordshire County councillor the other day who is a farmer, and the leader of Staffordshire County Council is also a farmer. And I said, this is a lifeline for the industry. County Council small holdings are a way in. You know, without that, I doubt we'd have ever actually been farming in our own right. You know, and even now, you know, you see one come up and there'll be 30, 40, 50, 100 applicants.
Definitely.
You know, you go to a viewing, or I mean, I've got guys that work for me that if one comes up, they're down there, they're looking, they've got ambition, they've got, you know, they've got plans. It's a way in, and it really is a step on the farming ladder. And as much as, you know, that when I rang the councillor from Staffordshire the other day, and he goes, well, do you think we should own units on industrial estates? And I'm going, well, if you could make some income out of it, perhaps you should. But, you know, they were there for a reason after the First World War, weren't they? Mm-hmm. But they have created a stepping stone, and a pretty vital one, I think, you know, for people in the industry. So if they're not there, I think it would be, you know, it would be a real shame. But, I mean, young people will still find a way in, but it'll just be a little bit harder, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's it, isn't it? At a time when there's a lot of talk about creating opportunities for young people, this just seems like a real kick in the teeth, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and it was Herefordshire Council made the decision, Staffordshire and that. It's constantly. I know that the tenant representative from the NFU, Chris Cardell, he spends half his life going around talking to councillors, talking to local authorities, urging them to actually not sell the family silver, and that's, you know, saying what it could put, what it does and can put back into the sort of rural economy.
So you said you're milking a couple of hundred cows there now. What kind of system do you run? Do you rear all your replacement heifers?
Yeah, we rear all our own young stock. We were selling surplus stock. We'd go up to Beeston or Market Drayton and sell the surplus stock, or privately. And then a couple of years ago, we sort of got shut down with TB for a while, and we made the decision that actually, you know, you can't sell surplus stock if you shut down with TB. So we moved over to predominantly sex semen and become much more selective about what we wanted to serve and what we wanted to keep, young stock from. So it's sort of sex semen, sex dynamic semen on what we want to keep and breed from. And then it's Belgian blue on everything else. And we no longer sell surplus stock, but it does mean that if we are, you know, and we've got a TB test again next month, if we do get shut up, we've got an animal that's actually adding value rather than black and white bull calves, which, you know, I'm not that good at fattening black and white bull calves. but I can put meat onto a Belgian blue if I get stuck. So, we've adapted the system, and actually it's created, you know, as much as it was nice to go and sell surplus stock, probably 9 times out of 10, you didn't actually get your money back. You don't, you know, because it's not cheap taking a heifer to 2 years of age.
No, well, as you say, I mean, so actually I was going to ask you about the TB situation in your area, because it's a big problem around here, and a lot of people have had to adapt their situation, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's one of the, you know, whilst Brexit has taken up a time, a lot of time of the EU, you know, there's still the day job, there's still the TB strategy, there's still the Gregory report, there's still how can we influence government to actually help us to get in front of this disease? Because as long as I've been kicking around with the NFU, we haven't got in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the calls are real positive, and you can see, you know, actually go out and visit some of the calls and the massive amount of work that people put into the if you ever think farmers can't collaborate and can't work together, go and speak to people that are running a call. Because actually, if you know what they've done has proved to me that actually farmers can do anything if they really, really set their mind to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so how far are you from Birmingham itself? You're pretty close, aren't you?
Probably the nearest dairy farm to the centre. I mean, I'm a tenant on of Cadbury's, and they bought the land just on the south side of Birmingham, in effect, to put farms there to get milk for the factory.
Is that right? Oh, that's really interesting. Right. Yeah.
That's why they did it. And the farm, our main farm, we've got two now, but the main farm was their own farm that they farmed themselves with a farm manager. And actually, I'm about 8 miles from the dead centre of Birmingham.
Are you?
We've got, you know, they were quite keen that the people of Bourneville and people of Birmingham didn't have to go very far to get fresh air. So they gave three blocks of land. In effect, you've got the Waisley Hills, the Lickey Hills and the Clent Hills, which are all three country parks, which are all just about linked together with the M5 running through the middle. And not Birmingham getting any bigger. And I farm on the edge of two of those.
Wow, okay. So what about, does it cause any problems being close to such a big urban area, or have you got, are you far enough away?
We are far enough away. More people are positive about agriculture and inquisitive and interested than anti it. I know at times, especially at the moment, we think we've been under constant attack from, you know, the sustainability of the livestock sector or January or something else. But actually, there's a footpath run straight through the middle of both the farmyards I've got. And most people want to talk about, oh, is the milk price better? You know, how's it going? I heard it wasn't so good. You know, can we look at the cows? Can we look at the calves? We do open farm Sunday. We get, you know, we've got a car park on for one of the parks at the top of the farm. We put a sign on there. And we had literally, you know, unbelievably diverse ethnicities come and visit the farm. We had people in burqas walking around. We had, you name it. And actually, you know, it was probably, I guess, one of the most diverse open farm Sundays, you know, ethnically that you could ever imagine. And it was brilliant. And we've done it a few years now. And it's always a great event.
Fantastic. Are you doing it again this year?
Well, yeah. I mean, the problem with doing what I do with the NFU, it always becomes a bit of an issue. And I end up dumping on the guys that work for me and going, hey, guess what? You know, you've got to tidy the farm up. You've got to do this. And you've got to do this. So I will be having the discussion with them. They always moan, but they love it on the day. They're great ambassadors. We milk on one side of the herringbone parlour, which takes twice as long, but actually the queue of people that want to get in there and watch you milk a cow, which is something that we take for granted, you know, is unbelievable. And some people will come at 10 in the morning and then say, oh, we're coming back again at 3 because we want to see the milking.
That's incredible.
It's such a draw, yet we just take it for granted.
Yeah, and everyone's positive. The people who come, they're all sort of, you don't get any negatives.
Yeah, no, we've never had any negatives at all. And we do get the odd vegetarian, but, you know, farmers grow vegetables, in my view.
Well, exactly.
I'll get more flack if I have a debate with a vegan on social media than if I open the farm up, to be honest. But that vegan could be in Toronto or anywhere in the world.
Well,
and quite often they are.
Yeah.
You know, well, you've done the same. You know? Well, you've tried to answer some vegan's question and all of a sudden you're having a debate with somebody on the other side of the world that hasn't got a clue.
Yeah, well, you quickly realise you're wasting your time, don't you? But
you do. You know which battles to fight, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. So you've obviously built the business up a lot over the last 40 years. Two grown-up sons, but neither of them wanting the farm.
Yeah, no, two grown-up sons, and they were quite cute when they were growing up. They weren't like me that sort of got ended up with jobs on the farm that became obligatory. They both made the decision that they never wanted to learn how to milk a cow, and they actually were very good and never did.
Yeah.
They never actually ended up milking a cow. They both would help me if I was stuck, even now. And they would when they were growing up. They both were into horses a little bit. One's now an equine dentist and based up in Shropshire and got a great business and lives up there with his wife. And I've got a granddaughter as well. So, you know, they're great and he's got a really good business going. And the youngest one is now a nurse, and he works in a new hospital in Birmingham.
Wow.
And lives with his partner in Worcester. And, you know, I'm really proud of both of them.
Yeah.
And I don't have an issue with them not wanting to farm, you know. What it does mean is I'm in this lucky position that I farm till I want to stop.
Yeah.
I do see it working other ways where people keep farming in the hope that the next generation will take it on. Well, I know they don't want to, but, and that's fine.
Yeah, no, I guess, yeah, it's quite interesting you say that, because I suppose it's, I've often thought about how I'd feel if the kids don't want to farm, and then you've sort of got that mixed emotion where maybe slight disappointment, but also a lot of relief as well, in a way.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're interested, yeah. But they don't want to do it. Literally, the decisions I make on a day-to-day basis, you know, every time I buy a new piece of kit, I'm 52 now, or 53, I've stopped counting. But, I think, I won't have to buy another Keenan again, or I won't have to buy a Manitou again. This one will see me out. And then last week I bought another Keenan, and then I'm planning to buy Manitou later. So, you know, as much as I say any of these things every time I change it, this one will see me out. You know, we're still investing, and we're looking at putting a new shed up for dry cows this year, you know, to make the dry cow management better. So now I've still got some go in me, and I'm not giving up just yet.
That's good to hear. See, you said to me that until recently you haven't been good at getting the work-life balance right. And that seems, for obvious reasons, to be quite hard for dairy farmers to do.
Yeah, no, I think I've been absolutely diabolical at that. I think both. I have a great relationship with my kids now, but that one's in his, you know, mid-30s, one's in his mid-20s, and we get on like best friends.
Uh-huh.
But it hasn't always been the case when, you know, and I can see it now in younger people. You get so tied into the farm and so tied into growing the business and everything else, you forget about making time for your family.
Yeah.
And the one thing that I would do differently, you know, I mean, I've never been particularly good at relationships either, let alone with my children or anybody else, because actually I just put the farm first all the time.
Yeah.
And we see people, I see people do it. And, you know, you don't go on holiday, you don't do all of these things because you just think, wrongly, that the farm can't cope without you.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when you do take time out the farm, you find it. I find my farm runs better when I'm not there. but for years, I thought it would collapse if I wasn't there.
Mm.
And you know, you don't. Your kids only grow up once, and you know, I would urge anybody that's got a young family, make time for them. And actually, the business should come second to everything else. But we see it time and time again, and I think it's a farming thing that you think you're the only one that can do it in the way you want it done, and you tie yourself to your own business, and your relationships suffer, and your relationship with your kids do. And it's only when you sort of get to 50 and then you get grandchildren that actually you start making time for your grandchildren when you actually should have made it for your own children, you know. And it's easy with hindsight, and I didn't see it at the time, and I was quite selfish, and I was, you know, just doing what I wanted to do because that's what I loved. But everybody else just had to deal with what I was left over, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, but, no, I think
I don't think that was particularly unusual, but
no.
I got to 50-odd and now I'm thinking, I wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky I still have got a good relationship with my children, but it is great now. But it hasn't always been. You know, there's been times when I'm sure they couldn't stand the sight of me and they'd moan at me because they wanted me to do something and I'd say, oh, sorry, I've got a cow calving or I've got a milk or I've got to do something else or, you know, and I didn't prioritise them. And that's, you know, that's probably one regret, really.
It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, obviously, I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves, don't we? We're proud people and it's a hard one because there's obviously a lot of talk now about mental health, isn't there? And people needing to just get off the farm a little bit and clear your head. But it's not easy.
I think all that talk is really, really positive because you do get in a rut and you do. I mean, when we started farming, I can remember, you know, my dad, we lived up a drive in Staffordshire. And I don't think he went off the second farm we had for 5 years.
Mm.
You know, my mother used to cut his hair, so he didn't need to go for a haircut. You know, and he didn't actually go off the farm for 5 years. He'd almost turned. He was doing a great job of farming, but actually, you know, he didn't leave the farm. And because he, you know, he was growing it and he was building it and we were doing it with him. And, you know, okay, I went to school. If I hadn't gone to school, I might have not left the farm.
Yeah. So tell me about Farmers for Action. You were one of the original group that created it. How did that initially come about?
Yeah, no, that was the case. We'd always been members of the NFU. I always saw them as old men in grey suits. Uh-huh. And, you know, you go along to an NFU meeting in your sort of early 20s, late teens, and it just wasn't for you. Mm-hmm. It was a whole world. And then, you know, the milk industry came under a lot of pressure, and I suddenly got a phone call. I think it was from Ray Brown up in Cheshire, or I don't know where it was from now. And they said, oh, we're getting a group of people together. We need to do something about this, and we're going to meet at Frankley Services. Well, that actually, for me, is at the bottom of one of my fields on the M5. So it was no distance to go. So I thought, well, I'll go along. And I gets there, and like I say, there was Ray Brown from Cheshire, David Handley, Brinley Williams from Wales at the time, who unfortunately has died now.
I remember Brinley, yeah.
He ended up in the Welsh, on the Welsh government.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, there was a guy called Rhys Parry. That was another Welsh guy that was involved with Aberdeen Angus. There was a real cross-section of people.
This would have been the mid to late 90s, was this?
Yeah. Ended up sitting in Frankly Services going, oh, you know, what's going on with the industry? We need to do something about this. So at that point, they said, right, we're going to go and close some supermarket distribution centres. And because I lived in the West Midlands, they said, oh, there's a big one over in Crick in the East Midlands, a Tesco distribution centre. You can go and do that. So then I left there thinking, what have I just said already? And so I then spent the next 4 or 5 days on the phone, phoning every Tom, Dick and Harry, people I'd never, ever met, just literally going through, you know, lists and lists and lists of farmers. And, you know, it was a Sunday night, I think, and, you know, because obviously the retailer ramps up for the week, you know, for the week ahead. And we decided we'd meet in a lay-by opposite this distribution centre in Crick, just off the M1, I think it was, I think it was the M1. And I gets there with a neighbour who, a good friend of mine, and we gets there about half an hour early, three quarters of an hour early. We parked in this lay-by and there was nobody there. And I thought, oh, bloody hell, nobody's coming. You know, if there's me and you, we're not going to do a very good job of shutting this. And he said, I think there's a pub up the road. So we went to this pub up the road, had a couple of pints, and then came back. And when we got back, the lay-by was heaving, the sides of the road was heaving. There was 300 to 400 farmers there. I gets out the car and they goes, right, what do we do now? Well, I hadn't got a bloody clue what we do. You know? So anyway, there was that many farmers there, and there was a farmer from the East Midlands who I'd never met before, who's since become a really good friend and now sits on the NFU Council as well, a guy called John Charles Jones, who said, actually, there's another ambient distribution centre down the road at Hinckley. Why don't I take half these farmers? We can go and shut the ambient distribution and you can shut the chilled distribution. Mm-hmm. And we can have twice as much effect. It sounded like a great idea because I hadn't got a clue what to do. So then we just wandered up this drive with half these farmers, stood in front of the Tesco distribution centre. And to be honest, you know, they didn't know what had hit them because we'd never done it before. They'd never experienced it before. And actually, you know, over the next couple of years on and off, we sort of had a few wins and a few victories and a few losses. But what it did do, what I saw was that you had farmers coming from every sector to support one sector on some occasions, you know. So you'd have arable and beef farmers coming along to support dairy.
Yeah.
But also you'd have large, you'd have extensive, you'd have intensive, you'd have tenants, you'd have, you know, owner-occupiers. And you'd all be that. It would be a great leveller because nobody knew whether you were worth millions or you owed millions, to be honest. But the one thing was for sure, it didn't matter whether you're sitting on a massive asset, your cash flow was the problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, it almost became therapeutic. And we talk about all these issues with mental health now. The times I stood there on a picket line and actually people, and it was usually the farmers' wives that would open up and go, actually, we can't pay the bills.
Yeah.
And, you know, and actually the fact that they come along and found out that other people couldn't make ends meet it's not just me then. It's not me being a bad farmer. It's actually the system doesn't work. Yeah. And, you know, there's something wrong. And I think it really did provide, a sort of, it was almost like therapy. It was. And people would come along and give up a lot of their spare time and give up sleep, but go home feeling like they'd at least, you know, had a chat and had achieved something. And to be honest, the FFA initially did achieve quite a few things. It did, you know, it did flag up the issues. It did actually get retailers around the table. It did get, you know, the supply chain around the table. But ultimately, I think for me, it showed that, you know, even though that was at times quite good fun, and I spent quite a lot of time sitting in police cars, you know, because they were, Mr. Oaks, can you come sit in this car, please? To speak to the chief inspector, and you'd end up negotiating with him that, well, if you give us a couple more hours, I promise we'll go home. And you'd sort of, and actually it was really surprising, a lot of policemen were ex-miners, and they'd seen the mining industry come under pressure, they'd seen, you know, that die, and actually they were generally supportive, so they'd always, you know, without saying it, give us a little bit longer than they really should have done, I guess. It did, as long as we didn't do anything stupid. And you know, this is a lot. If we give you 4 hours, we want you to honour that and go in 4 hours. If you'd have turned around and said no, we're going to stay a bit longer, you know, you could have been in trouble. But most of the time, you know, the relationship between the police and even the people in the distribution centres, we'd get a lot of lorry drivers were farmers that were doing, you know, that were doing a shift driving a HGV lorry. Who go, don't worry, mate, I'm not going to drive past you. So you didn't, you know, if the first one stopped, you didn't have to do anything because he wasn't going to drive through. But ultimately it was, you know, whilst it was good fun, it was therapeutic. I think I came to the conclusion that there had to be a better way. And some of the people that had supported me and supported the FFA were quite big, you know, quite vocal members of the NFU. And they said, well, actually get more involved with the NFU. And that's what happened. And you sort of, you know, if you look at a lot of people now in NFU, they went through that same journey as I did on the way to where we are today.
So how did you just initially get involved at regional level?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to be on the Worcestershire. At the time, there was a Worcestershire Milk Committee, and all I wanted to do was be on the Worcestershire Milk Committee. And I went along to the local branch, and there is a saying in the NFU, if you're not careful, you can go a long way. And I think I probably, you know, can prove that. So I went along to the local branch, and I think it was just before the national AGM when it was still in London. And they said, oh, we pay for one member in Worcestershire every year to go to the NFU AGM. This year it's our branch's turn. We want to send you. So before I knew it, I was, you know, going off to London for the AGM. And you've been to the AGM, and it's not until you go for the first time you actually see the depth and the breadth and the quality of the people the NFU has for them. You don't see it till you sort of
you're absolutely right though. I went for the first time last year, as you know, and I was absolutely struck by how many talented and committed people there are involved in the NFU.
It's fighting our call. And it's just a shame not every member and every non-member can see that. But I mean, it's not till you go. So I got sent along to this AGM. And before I knew it, I think I was, you know, county vice chairman, but, you know, within I don't know, it wasn't minutes, but it felt like it. And then you sort of get dragged in at county level, and it was before emails. So, I mean, the fax machine used to be going all night, you know, emails you now get from the NFU. It used to be faxes. So, I mean, I got through a few forests with the paper, and the machine would be going all night printing these things. You know, most of it, at least now, I can choose to read it or not or delete. But in those days, there'd be half a forest in the office of fax paper, and it would all be just information about what the NFU was doing, what it was, you know, for every sector. Because, you know, okay, now I just concentrate on dairy in effect, but, you know, when you're sort of county chairman, they give you everything. And then Foot and Mouth came along in 2012, and you really saw the NFU being seen as the organisation that DEFRA needed to work with. If they needed farmers to cooperate and collaborate and get in front of the disease, you know, it needed somebody to talk to. And the NFU was that logical body, along with some other partners and stakeholders.
Do you think it's important that perhaps now more than ever that people do stand up and get involved in industry bodies like the NFU and...
Yeah, no, I do. But like you say, it's not till you get into a certain level that you can see. And not, you know, I'm very fortunate that, you know, when I first got involved, my father sort of took a step back from doing anything to do with the industry politics and said, well, you get on with doing that, I'll stop at home and actually the work gets done. So yeah. So and that was quite unusual, because sometimes it's the other way around. And so he went, well, no, you can do that. He'd rather stop at home. And so he supported me and sort of, you know, and backed me. And, you know, you can sort of get dragged in, and you can, I mean, it was quite funny. You go to the NFU AGM, which you were at last week and the year before, and you go to other meetings. You'll see people there that are, you know, there's people that see that they want a political career in the NFU. And they'll, you know, you'll see them. They always make a speech in a session. They always have something to say. Well, for me, you know, and actually they're very good at keeping their profile up. And that's great if that's what you want to do. Well, actually, I find everything happens to me by accident. You know, I'm the opposite. I sort of, you know, I never planned to be, you know, the county chairman. I never planned to be the chairman of the West Midlands. I never planned to be the dairy board chair. But it just seems to happen. Yeah. Whereas, you know, so there's various ways that, you know, you can either plan it and you can, you know, put yourself in a position, or you can find that it just happens to you. But ultimately, you know, there is a lot of support. You know, there's a lot, there's, you know, we have teams of people, you know, whatever we do on dairy isn't just me. I've got a great board and I've got a great, you know, backroom, you know, advisors, whether that's for the environment, whether that's for tax, whether that's for tenancies, whether that's for whatever it is we have to deal with. There are people there that know far, far more than I do that I can just call on. So it's great.
Yeah. It's funny you should say that, because I never planned to have a podcast and be doing all this either. That just happened to me by accident.
It does just happen to you, doesn't it?
It does. So a lot of your work at the moment as chair of the National Dairy Board will be with Brexit. It's obviously such a complex, difficult subject, but are you concerned at the moment? I mean, Michael Gove obviously spoke at the conference last week, the Secretary of State, and said all the right things, but do you think they'll get it right?
And Michael Gove only said the right things because Minette Butters, obviously our president, put him in it, but he couldn't say anything else. And I think she did do a brilliant job of getting him to promise that he would put in writing that he would protect, you know, our standards on welfare and environment and, you know, and all the positives that we've got in our industry. And he did it, and you heard him putting that in writing. I haven't seen it yet, and I don't think she has either. But we won't let him forget that he did. He said that in front of a very public audience. You know, on tariffs, he also promised that he would come back with, you know, and put tariffs in place to protect our industry. Because for me, the biggest fear is that we fall out of Europe, and there's a real danger as we get close to the end of March that we could fall out by accident almost. And once that happens, that's the reality. We're on WTO rules at that point. Our government won't want food inflation, so it could say, actually, zero tariff to import into the UK. But you would have 45% on tariffs on lamb. You would have 65% on beef. You would have the equivalent of 14 pence a litre on a ton of cheddar, you know. And actually, we would be totally uncompetitive for export at that point. Yeah, we would be exposed to not just European imports with zero tariffs, but imports from anywhere in the world. And actually, you know... Minette talks about it would be catastrophic, and that's no exaggeration. It really would. Because how would we compete? We would be farming with both our hands tied behind our backs, wouldn't we?
Absolutely. And you, like me, as we mentioned earlier, are a tenant farmer. do you think that the government are taking into account enough that around 30% of us are tenant farmers in this country on rented farms when they're drawing up the new agricultural policy?
We spent a lot of time both on Brexit and, you know, pulling together the new, you know, agricultural policy, which actually should be a real opportunity. You know, whilst Brexit is a threat, the opportunity to put together an ag bill, which is made for the UK agriculture, should be a real opportunity. I don't think, you know, I think at the moment there's not enough emphasis on food. You know, there's a massive emphasis on the environment.
Yeah.
I think the two have to work together. But at the minute, you know, the environment is pushing the the white paper forward. It should be sustainable, profitable food production with a lighter environmental footprint, you know, and that actually delivers what, you know, a sustainable industry going forward. I know we keep having that debate with DEFRA. We keep having that debate with Michael Gove and George Eustace. Hopefully they'll get the message. He did very much talk about pulling together a commission on food production at conference, which was one of the other positives. And I know we won't let go of that. You know, he made that. He said it was a great idea. It is a good idea. You know, the NFU is prepared to work with whoever it takes to deliver this. Mm-hmm. And by pulling that sort of food and food production commission together, you know, I think perhaps we can get food and food production higher up the agenda of the white paper. Because ultimately, you know, wherever we go with Brexit, and we do want free and frictionless trade, and I'll probably sound like a parrot, that's probably what we need.
Yeah.
For many sectors to actually survive, you know, we need also, you know, food production to be valued and, you know, and a country that can actually feed itself.
Absolutely. What about the rise of these anti-dairy activists? We've seen these sort of shadowy groups cropping up online where they're supposedly publishing the addresses of dairy farms. What do you say to that, and what's your advice to farmers who might be worried about that situation?
Over the years, as I've been dairy board chairman, when we first started to get attacked by the vegans, you know, I would write a letter to the Telegraph, or I would, you know, we would on behalf of the NFU go bang straight back at them head to head, and you know, we put in a complaint to the Advertising Standards Agency. And actually, all it did, it was a bit like getting a can of petrol and pouring it on the fire. They loved it. They thought, oh, this is great. We've pissed the NFU off. We must be doing something right. and that was the reality of it. I mean, they almost like reinvigorated them. That, you know, that I'd taken the trouble, or we'd taken the trouble to respond. And initially what we did in dairy, we did a very short, quick, very easy thing called Proud of Dairy, which actually we just got farmers to video themselves saying why they were proud to be a dairy farmer. And then in 2 weeks, we drowned out their noise when they were trying to make more noise. And we didn't respond to them. We were just going. And actually, farmers are pretty good with a mobile phone and a bunch of cows licking in the rear or whatever. and actually just saying, this is how it is. This is why I love my job. These are my cows. This is what we do. And that was brilliant. And that taught me something that actually, we as an industry, you know, don't need to necessarily, you know, go head to head with these people. We've got a great product. I mean, I'll probably, you know, dairy in itself has got more calcium, phosphorus, potassium, zinc, a whole list of products per calorie than any other food.
Yeah.
No other food can replicate that. You know, it actually is a superfood. Yeah, now, we forget that sometimes. And just over the last few months, we feel like we've been constantly under attack. I think, you know, we've got to be cuter at the way we market ourselves. We've got to be better. And I think, you know, between Dairy UK and AHDB, they did the dairy-related Department of Scrumptious Affairs last year. That was a massive hit. That's going to build. They're going to build on that this year. You know, there's loads and loads of positives. But at the same time, and I've done this into the guys that work for me and myself, because we can all have a bad day when you swear at a cow because it's just trodden on your foot. You know, we ultimately you know, need to remember that, you know, don't, you know, somebody could be filming you. You know, don't do anything you wouldn't do in front of your mother or a girl you were trying to impress. You know, I mean, basically just actually at all times, just remember, you know, we are the shop front for the industry. So don't do anything you wouldn't want a customer to see. And I think we've got to get that mentality into our sector, even with things like, you know, it's easy to swear at a cow, you know, because you're having a bad day and the cow's done nothing wrong. And it, you know, and that may be quite normal, but you put that in the context of a film that they then put on social media, it can be made to look quite sinister. And, you know, I know they've broken into, one of my board members' farms, and they did it at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's an amazingly well invested, extremely high welfare farm. But they got down on the floor and filmed through the cubicles and made it look like the cows were all behind bars.
Yeah.
So actually, they can make something that we perceive to be, you know, some of the best welfare standards look quite sinister because it's half light, it's dark, they're down there filming from the floor upwards, you know. So we've just got to be really conscious and actually got better at, you know, making sure that we are, you know, happy to be the shop window for our industry and actually stand up for ourselves in that kind of way rather than go head to head with them.
Yeah, absolutely agree. So you opened the dairy session at the conference last week. Did you get good feedback and what came out of that session?
Yeah, I mean, we were determined a bit because of the sort of, you know, farmers thinking they were under constant attack from the sustainability of the sector or Veganuary or whatever, the calf project, whatever it happened to be. We thought, right, we're going to make sure, you know, I've been to too many dairy sessions where, you know, we all end up talking the price down. We all end up talking the industry. You know, it's doom and gloom by the time everybody leaves the room and you all want to go away and cut your throat. Well, actually, I thought, well, you know, this is my second opportunity as Dairy Board Chair to host this event. Let's actually talk about the positives. So we did. We talked about the work the NFU was doing on contracts. We talked about everything we were doing on the environment. We got Rebecca Meir and Susie Stannard from AHDB who are doing some brilliant stuff on marketing and the other one on, you know, what consumers want. And actually, I think everybody went out of that room going, actually, that has been really informative, really upbeat. And we, you know, the industry is still where it is. We didn't change that in 2 hours. But actually, there is a massive amount of positive stuff going on. And sometimes we get buried under the crap. And yeah. Need to flag up that, you know, this is going on, this is good, you know, actually, and you have a great product. Yeah. And, you know, I think there was a buzz when people left the room. For me, it worked better than I expected. It was great. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the stats of the conference came out of it, didn't it? Dairy products have a penetration rate of 98%, which is technically higher than toilet paper.
Well, yeah, you know, don't worry about buying more dairy products than toilet paper. But, that's a fact, and that'll come from Qatar or whatever.
Yeah,
you know, dairy products get into more homes than toilet paper. I hate to think about it too much, but it's a great product. It is a great fact.
Remarkable stat. So you've been 3 years as chair of the NFU Dairy Board. What are some of your highlights? You must have done a lot of things that you never thought you'd do, I would think.
Well, yeah, I quite often have to pinch myself and remind myself I'm a dairy farmer from the West Midlands. And you know, I went to Korea this year to the World Dairy Summit. And that's, you know, two of the people that presented at conference had presented in Korea. And I went up to them afterwards. And this was October going, I want you at conference, you know. Mm-hmm. And to see, you know, you, where we are in the UK against the rest of the world, both in marketing our product, both in, you know, product innovation, both in, you know, and on farm, you know, was a real eye opener and a real privilege. You know, so that was great. You know, I'm in and out of Westminster and in and out of DEFRA almost on a weekly basis. You know, the contact you get with, you know, the policymakers and people like that. Is unbelievable. And just you know, this week coming, I will be 2 days in the northwest. 2 days in the northwest, then drive down to Cornwall for Thursday for meetings in Cornwall and Somerset. So, you know, one minute you can be sat with the minister or senior DEFRA officials, and the next you're sat around the kitchen table with a bunch of farmers that actually are looking to you to help lead the industry forward. I mean, it is a massive responsibility, but it's a great honour as well. And we don't always agree. And lots of farmers will tell me they think I'm wrong on lots of occasions. But we will have a good debate on it, and I do listen. So, you know, I think actually sitting around a kitchen table with a bunch of farmers and them all going, yeah, we want to back you and we want you to keep doing what you're doing. There's no better feeling, to be honest.
Absolutely. So what are your hopes for the year ahead for the UK dairy industry? Big question with the year we've got after March.
yeah, who knows? We don't, you know, ideally we don't want to crash out of Europe. Mm. We do want some kind of trading relationship for the next 2 years while we sort out the long-term deal. You know, that for dairy is vital, even more so for the red meat sector. You know, it ultimately, you know, we will, I think as an NFU and as an industry, we would have to do things quite differently if we fall out for a period of time. Just prioritizing the way we did things, and really, it could change a lot of things in a short period of time. Now, ultimately, you know, as an industry, we're used to being challenged, and we're used to, you know, things actually derailing our plans. Mm-hmm. But and we're quite adept at sort of getting around things. But that one would take a bit of doing if we fall out. But if we end up with a good deal, there's a whole host of things we need to do. We've got, you know, DEFRA, when it gets back down to doing the day job, is looking at, you know, air quality, and it's looking at emissions from dairy farms and large livestock units. We need to make sure whatever they do is the right thing. You know, I went over to Holland this year with DEFRA thinking, and DEFRA thought, oh, the Dutch have got all the solutions on ammonia emissions. Now, what they've done is actually forced farmers to spend a lot of money,
yeah,
but still weren't aware that they'd actually improved any of the outcomes. So we don't want to do that as an industry, do we? We don't want to have a whole lot of cost to dairy farmers without actually achieving some of the outcomes. So I think we've got to work smarter with DEFRA to find solutions rather than go for what they perceive to be the easy, quick wins when actually it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, absolutely. All right then, Michael. Well, I always end these on the five quick questions, as you know, hard-hitting questions. I'm sure you'll be able to handle them, but are you ready?
Yeah, we'll give it a go.
What's your all-time favourite song?
I think it's Stairway to Heaven, Led Zeppelin. I sort of grew up with it. And there was a youth club down the road from before I went to Young Farmers. I used to go to this youth club, and every Thursday night they'd have a sort of disco. But it was all sort of rock music, and that would always come on. If it wasn't that one, it would have to be, when I went to Young Farmers, it would probably be 10cc, I'm Not in Love, because at the end of the night, that would come on last night.
Yeah, of course, yeah. If you were stranded on a desert island far away from your cows, what three items would you want with you?
A bottomless bottle of red wine. Something to play music on. And then this might seem a strange one, but my sister-in-law, because she's a great cook and she seems to be able to make food out of anything, so that might not go down well with everybody, but I think I'd at least get fed.
All right, if you could go back in time and give your 16-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Use contraception.
I'm sure your boys would be happy to hear that.
Well, yeah. Right now, but I may do a few things differently.
Yeah. All right. What's the first thing you'd do if you won the lottery?
Oh, pay off the overdraft.
Yeah.
Pay off the overdraft and probably buy a few more cows, strangely enough, because it's a bit of a habit, isn't it?
That's such a farmer answer, isn't it? Almost all farmers would say that.
I think, you know, perhaps, you know, if it was big enough, you'd buy some kind of holiday home somewhere so you could escape from the farm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And lastly then, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in agriculture to follow on social media, who would it be and why?
Oh, there's, you know, I was thinking about this one. There's so many good ones. You know, you've got the farmers of the UK on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, that's great, and it changes, and so many people that aren't farming learn so much from that one. Mm-hmm. You've got the likes of Abby Reader, who are just constantly promoting the industry. They're probably Abby, because I mean she's great, and you know, with her cows on tour. But even, you know, yourself, you know, you do it constantly. There's almost too many to mention, and. But no, there are some really good ones out there, but probably Abby Reader, because, I mean, she's young, she's just so enthusiastic, and she just never stops.
Yeah. Are you going up Snowdon with the cow?
Along with Stuart Roberts, who's said, although he did send me a message today after the rugby at the weekend, he's not inclined to go to Wales again. So I'm not sure he still wants to do it. He's sort of lost his enthusiasm a little bit.
I'll be there.
I made commitment to Abby to go, so I'll be there.
I'll be there too with my two oldest daughters, who are ridiculously excited about it. So yes, I will see you there. Right, it has been great to finally speak to you. Like I said, we've been trying to do it for a year now, but I'm really glad we finally got there.
No, I really enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Good, and best of luck for the year ahead. Keep up the great work with everything you do for the dairy industry.
We'll try.
And
give it a go.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening. Hope to see you next time I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.